her voice muffled under the tape. Kate sets one hand on the burner dial under Johanna's legs while holding a syringe, which I presume is filled with pento, to Johanna's jugular.
Johanna, my Johanna. Be quiet, love. Be quiet. Look at me being quiet for you. I will sit silent and be quiet because quiet will make her stop. And I am going to sit here on the floor with my blood legs and my bleeding hand and the bees in my brain and without my feet. And I am going to make all of me and even my blood and even the bees be very, very quiet. And we are going to be quiet. And the woman is not going to hurt you, Johanna. Johanna, shh, shh, Johanna.
I am a nurse. My legs are not blood. My right thigh has a throbbing hematoma. My left hand is lacerated and requires 10 sutures. My brain is not filled with bees. It is oxygen deprived because I am still only inhaling in bursts through my throat. I do not close my eyes to inhale through nostrils as I should. You surely should. I surely should. Kate keeps her hand on the burner dial and a needle to Johanna's neck. Kate Dranel clears her throat, stops humming about America. She looks at me with one eyelid dropping like she's having a stroke. But it's more that she's moving through a quick catatonic state. I should know. She's a reflection of me in this moment. Then she clears her throat again, and both eyes fly wide, and she's staring at me on the floor, her syringe in one hand to Johanna's jugular, her other hand on the burner dial on which Johanna is trapped. Kate speaks.
Oh, my dear, Lynette Viola Vandenbeer. What a fucking lovely name. Rich bitch has everything she needs, but she wants a married man. So she takes him and fucks him. Kent told me everything.
Don't look at her. Look at Johanna. Tell her to be quiet. Be quiet with me, Johanna. Johanna, don't look at my blood legs sprawled here on the floor with the broken bowls. Nana's bowls are broken. I'm so sorry. Don't look at my bloody hand or the bees buzzing around my head. Stop crying, darling. Look in my eyes and be quiet. Can you see my eyes? Are they too clouded? Okay, darling, I'll wipe them.
I wipe my crying eyes so Johanna can see me being quiet, which, medically speaking, should not make physiological sense, but it is logical to me, so I wipe again. The blood from my left hand swipes across my face. I must look like a red raccoon.
You look at me when I'm talking to you, bitch! Kate Dranel shouts from her towering height. Me crumpled on the floor by the shaken shelves, broken yellow pottery all around me. The heavy bottom of one of the big bowls we use to mix cakes, the one that is an inch thick, teeters by my hand, the edges around the bottom now jagged and sharp. The way Kate bends from her height to me and shouts is like she's an abusive mother with a wooden spoon at the stovetop, shouting at a quivering child at her apron strings.
You will sit there and listen to everything I'm going to say, or I will turn on the burner and burn your sister alive, right here on your stove. Or who knows, I could also pump her with this pentobarbital right into her neck. And I think this much quantity would kill her, or coma her for fucking ever. And who knows, maybe you'll lose more tonight. I don't know what I'll do, but you will listen either way.
I will make you a nice cup of tea, Johanna, tonight. Your favorite, my love, yes, the caffeine-free rooibos chai with milk and honey and 2 slices of cinnamon toast with no crust and buttered heavy. I'll give you the rest of the wine, too, and we'll go away tomorrow. We'll get away, get away, get away, way, way, and maybe we'll go to your favorite little villa in Positano and we'll sleep late, just like you like. I'll get you whatever you need. Please, please be still. Stop fidgeting. The needle cannot go into your neck. Please be quiet. I will be quiet. See? Please, Johanna.
I am not quiet. My mouth works against me. You fucking crazy bitch. I swear to God, if you hurt my sister, I will make your living life a fucking hell. I'm seething, literal spit frothing out of my mouth. I don't know what I'm saying. I'm a nurse. I should talk reason into this situation, diffuse the tension like I'm trained.
Kate Dranel is laughing, a nasally laugh, clogged and halting, a car working to stop in the rain and the anti-lock wheels can't catch.
Oh, really?
Please, Lynette Viola Vandenbeer, she says my full name like a bully on the playground. What a bitch's name. And your sister's name, please, Johanna Vandenbeer Pentecost. She's a cunt. You're a cunt. Fuck you.
Kate moves to crouch in front of me, blocking me from reaching Johanna at the stove. But at least her hand is off the burner dial and the vial away from Johanna's neck. She hikes up her gown to her knees, fisting the scratchy tulle lining, which is ripped in spots. She wears no lining, no underslip, no Spanx,
because she's an animal.
The stitching on this dress is uneven. It's homemade. It's awful. It's psychotic. She made this dress.
She made this dress. Oh, do you like my dress, bitch?
She says in a taunt, pivoting her head with each word, side to side.
I made it. I thought maybe if you saw my beautiful gown, you'd invite me to your stupid charity ball this Friday. Right? Yeah, I read up on you. I made this dress all last night and today, in between dealing with Kent, of course.
And she's doing her phlegmy, rattling, awful laugh again. When she crouches, her hiked gown rides up her formless legs, and yet she keeps her indecent crouching pose, her knees hovering and splayed to each side, her pointed elbows jammed into the tops of her thighs. This position is much like a tracker in the woods, crouched to the ground, pontificating over evidence. I can see the crotch of her cotton underwear, a large, earth-covering grandma pair. No wonder Kent preferred me and my Brazilian wax. I'm fixed on thoughts of Kent folding this exact pair of yellow underwear, which I presume came from a plastic package of three. This is not rational to concern myself with Kate Dranel's underwear. I am a nurse. I am a fucking nurse. Can I reason my way out of this? Is there a logical or medical solution? Johanna, she's talking to me now. This is good, darling, good, good, good. Be still. I will speak with her to free you.
Get out of my house, you bitch.
What am I saying? I'm losing this situation. Johanna, 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 I am talking to her, darling. We'll go away tomorrow, I promise.
Kate Dranel caws at me like a crow with a dry throat. You don't get it, do you? Lynette Viola Vandenbeer, you may be a nurse, but you're dumb. There's no way out of this. You don't get it, do you?
Perhaps I do not get it. I look to her face, which leans in on me now. Her face is a full moon, but sagged and dry, showing her age. Her dragging, tactless eyeliner drags more. She doesn't care for herself, doesn't use toner or moisturizer, doesn't give a shit about her appearance, not in a graceful, aging, or benevolent, apathetic kind of way, rather in an aggressive, you will look at me as is entitled way. And based on the catch I hear in her throat, and the age weight she's showing in the middle and her hips, I bet she neglects a disorder of the thyroid, likely hypo.
Kent tried to help you before with your stash of pento. I never knew where he got it, but I've figured it out now. When he told me last night that he was leaving me for you, that you're opening up a clinic here, and that you're pregnant, I figured it out.
She looks at my liquid legs, raises an eyebrow.
We're pregnant,
she adds on a chuckle, and raises her never-plucked eyebrows at whatever she sees on my legs. I won't look down. I won't acknowledge her last line, her correction to the past tense about my present pregnancy. I stare at her, breathing fast inhales through my nose. I see three of her face. She's still talking, three mouths talking, not entirely in sync, but saying the same words, awful past tense words.
I'm not an idiot, Lynette.
Johanna, just be quiet. Listen, darling, let her talk. Johanna is flagging. She's no longer screaming or thrashing about. Her eyelids are falling. She may be blacking out from shock. Will she remember tonight? I hope she doesn't remember tonight. I am a nurse. Traumatic experiences can cause a form of amnesia. Selective, comprehensive, progressive, regressive, all kinds of amnesia.
I never knew who exactly Kent was fucking. Or actually, what I mean is who all he was fucking. You're not his only whore, Lynette. Kent told me everything. Then I came and ransacked your damn clinic, which is so fucking elitist and weird, and found your damn vials last night. He told me all about how you two were going to run a private clinic in your barn. He was very specific on how great your lives were going to be. So I didn't need your stupid fucking note and hospital ID this morning, but hoo-hoo! She pauses to exclaim a loud relief sigh. Sure was entertaining. And leaving your ID in my house like that? Hilarious. Oh, I got your ID from my car, all right. Put it in my house. Oh, you stalker. Might explain the blood in the tub, yeah? You did it, Lynette. That's what the evidence says, at least. She is framing me. She's still talking. And then what? Well, poor me worked all day. You dragged my husband's dead body to your crazy lair in his Jeep. And then you went to work like nothing happened? Wow. She is framing me. She is framing you. I know what you're thinking. You have an alibi for this whole day. Johanna, your sister, right? Well, she won't be around much longer. No worries. What a waste. Kent didn't really love you. He loved what's under your skirt. And what's under your skirt is getting old. Oh, he loved me. I loved him. But maybe you're right, Kate Dranel. I'm listening, because listening is the logical thing to do to save my sister. This is the procedure I am to follow. It is the medical rationality we need. I am a nurse, so I am listening. Johanna, look, darling. Okay, don't look. You black it out. I'll take you away, love. My legs are bleeding, but it's okay. Do not worry, love. The bees are still there, yes, but do not worry. I'm making them spin clockwise now, so it's okay. Again, I tell myself my legs are not bleeding, but I am not accepting this. I remind myself that the bees are really my brain vessels, screaming for air. Literally, the vessels are screaming at me to give them air, or else they'll let the bees back in to fly daisy loops and with no organizing circular pattern. I stare at Kate Dranel. My eyelids are falling, too. I force them open. I force a consciousness. Oh, Lynette, I could think of you and me as two women betrayed by the same man, right? I could consider him the common problem, not us. But nope, you're the problem, whore. So here is what is going to happen. If anyone finds out about Kent and where his dead body is, the toxicity report will show pento, and homicide detectives would then see a very common pattern. Jilted mistress, you killed him in my house, dragged him here to your crazy lair. You're basically fucked. It's ironic, right? You kept your life so otherwise offline. No electronic trail, nothing between you and Kent, which I know because I'm in all his accounts now. His password is so pathetic. It's your fucking dumb name, Liv Viola V33. She's still crouching when she scooches closer to me, so now her hips mirror mine and her dry face is in my face. Her feet must be stinging in restricted circulation below the knees. She continues, irony, your electronic absence will make it easy for me to claim no connection or knowledge of you. I'll just act, golly gee, shocked. She snorts from her nose, and I notice she's never plucked the hairs of her nostrils. She sucks in her cheeks and makes a fish face, contemplating me watching her, and then she jerks to standing, looking in the corners of my ceiling. She indicates she's about to launch into a monologue, a villain proud to unfurl her world-ending plot. No security cameras here, she announces loudly, her flabby arms indicating the corners of the ceiling. The blue-on-blue top layer of her misshapen homemade gown swishes against the torn tulle. She sets a dramatic finger to her chin to indicate she's analyzing out loud, her monologue to roll now. Maybe a good detective working hard could put things together and link me. Maybe. But who cares? You might still scream and shout how I'm to blame, but I came here analog last night, found your damn vials, and have an airtight alibi today and tonight. I walked 10 fucking miles to get here last night. No phone on me, no trace, no cell tower pings. I know everything I've touched, and no evidence will stay. No fingerprints, nothing. Kent's Jeep in your driveway, which I drove here tonight, him dead in the back seat for right. Yes, I did drive his body here. Couldn't carry him 10 miles. Whatever. Evidence of his car here fits with my story. No one saw me driving or when. It's an old Jeep. No GPS tracker to time anything. No nothing. I made damn sure. She smacks her lips and winks at me as a pause and to accentuate her high opinion of herself. She's just so genius. As for his blood in my house, I'm a nurse too, Lynette. Not a drop of it escaped the tub. He went straight into airtight plastic once his body drained, and I dragged him out the hay house. She says this last part, out the house, in a strange southern accent and twisted head, like she's talking to herself, and this entire monologue of hers is a mottled stew of actors in a circle on a stage. Fortunately, our garage is attached. Still southern accent, but she switches back to her grating Boston accent with the next line. Right. I insisted on an attached garage, Lynette, when we bought our home. She pouts in a whiny voice upon saying our home. You wanted to steal our home, Lynette. Well, fuck you. I bleached my bathroom floor after I removed Kent, you cunt. I'll drain the tub when I get home and marinate the porcelain in bleach a few days, if you play nice, nice. She rolls her eyes to the ceiling, mocking herself for being sad and saying upon a forced laugh, I wanted something of him in the house when I got home. She's making no sense. Her framing of me, her keeping the blood in the house, nonsensical. Applying reason to lunacy is a futile insanity. But she's twisted me up in this, and she could frame me long enough for me to lose everything. I'm a nurse, and the two stark facts I can't avoid, no matter what Kate Dranel drones on about, are these. Kent is dead in Mop's room, and my sister is duct-taped on top of my gas stove. Kate spits on her own laughter at her own psychosis, and then, with shoulders sagging, weeps in ugly heaving. But not for long. She springs up straight and finishes in a breathless rant. I sent a resignation email from him to the hospital. Kent's on it. Vague and undefined mission to help Syrian refugees in Greece. She swipes her lips to the side and air quotes the vagueness of mission to help refugees to once again accentuate the laughable genius of her own plan. He's got no family, you know. No one will report him missing, unless I choose to. I'm in control here. I don't have anyone either. Kent and I had only each other. For real, no one else. And you took the both of us away, Lynette, so you pay. She quick crouches, sticking her yellow crotch direct in my line of sight once again. She's hissing, slow and in my face. I am in control here, bitch. You're gonna play along so I don't report Kent missing. What is the woman with the syringe saying? Who is she? Are those words, or is she humming again? What is this wind that smells of cheese in my face? Breath? Joanna, 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 darling. She's feeding me cheese. See, we're talking and eating cheese, so this is good. Please, this will be over soon. Be quiet. Hush. Kate Dranel. Yes, it's Kate Dranel. The proximity of her close face and cheese breath. These are smelling salts, jolting me to listen and burn her words to my brain. So as insurance for me, and because I want you to suffer, you're going to drag Kent into your basement behind your fake bookcase. I followed your dumb humming sister around tonight. She didn't hear me when she opened the bookcase to take out wine. Had her earphones on, singing Paul Simon. Kate's laughing again, her catching awful phlegmy cough laugh like an old crazed lady. I think of flowers in the attic. Joanna, it's just a story, darling, like flowers in the attic. We'll be done with the story soon. I'll finish the book. You go to sleep.
I'll sum it up for you tomorrow, like I always do, if you want. Shh, shh, sleep, my love.
If you ever say anything about who killed Kent or Vicky, my neighbor with the damn peanuts, remember, Lynette, I've got three things on you.
She takes her free hand and pushes fingers to my nose to accompany her recitation of the three things she has on me.
One, she presses my nose once, Kent with Pento in every fiber of his dead body. Two,
she pushes twice,
you were at Proserpina's. You can be blamed for lacing Vicky with peanuts. Yeah, you whispering in my ear. I figured that out, too, even before you left your stupid note. You have impulse control problems, don't you, Lynette? Anyway, I'll say I went to the bathroom and the police will assume you leaned over then. I mean, you were there. And Vicky was, in fact, sleeping with Kent. Lynette, you're such a crazy bitch. Oh, Lordy.
She pauses to collect her breath from a cackling in laughter through these words.
And three,
she says, losing her demented smile and laughter, getting serious. She pushes three times, jamming into my nose like she's trying to push it to the back of my skull.
Drum roll, please.
She's off humming America once again. Kate Dranel stands, walks backward toward Johanna, and continues talking, not humming.
You know where I caught your sister? She was smoking a cigarette on her bed out there.
She pointed toward the guest cottage.
She just lit it, in fact. Left the cigarette teetering on the fold of the duvet. All it would take is the right gust of wind from the open window, and...
Kate makes a whooshing sound and fans her hand in a dramatic display to charade fire as she mouths the word. She turns a circle like a contemplative professor.
So, this gave me an idea. When you crawled your whore ass up the stairs just now and found Kent, and you were up there forever, geesh. Anyway, I ran out to that dumb cottage, lit another cigarette, and left it on the sheets. The one I lit sure teetered on the duvet. Whoopsie-doo.
Kate laughs as she stares out the back bay window toward the cottage. She sniffs the air.
Smell it, Lynette? Oh, and your sister is so dumb. She was reading some dumbass romance novel. Smut! Oh, yeah, the title.
And here she does her awful laugh again, looking at my sister and lifting Johanna's dropped chin to look in her face. I spring on all fours. I'm a guard dog coming to life after eating a drugged steak. The thick yellowware bowl bottom with jagged edges is under my right hand's grip.
Yes, right, the book's title,
Kate says into Johanna's face,
was Dirty Blonde Cowboy. You had no idea. I stood at the foot of the bed until I kicked the baseboard. Must have been the spent bottle of wine. Anywho.
Kate turns to face me, but keeps her hand squeezing Johanna's chin so as to keep her head cocked upright. Something catches her eye outside, and she looks to the back kitchen window toward the guest cottage. I follow her eyes. At the level I am at, given how the window sash is low, the house being on higher level than the cottage, I see a brighter core within the lit cottage, a core of slow-growing orange, a fire on the bed.
Oh, now finally here we are, Kate says, looking back at me, growling a large smile in a coming glee and perking up her posture. I think this decides it. Poor Johanna, your sister.
She's humming again, transforming beautiful poetry into a theme song for a horror carnival.
Yep, here's what the papers will say about this twit, Johanna. She fell asleep with the cigarette in her mouth, and it fell and burned the bed. And when she woke up burning alive, she ran. Oh, yes, that's it, Lynette, your sister. She ran to the cliff, flaming on fire, and she launched herself into the ocean. Remember these details, because all this shit here is what you'll say, the story you will tell, or else you're going to jail for the rest of your worthless life. I'm going to pump her full of pento now, a dose enough to kill her, your pento. You knew I'd have to kill her. It's all your fault. Can't have any other witnesses other than you, whore, and you need to live because you need to suffer. I'll be off now. You better get a move on and get to hiding these dead bodies, nurse. Fire trucks will probably come soon. Here's the third thing I have on you.
Kate Dranel sinks the pentobarbital, I think an entire vial's worth, but it's hard to tell, into Johanna's jugular or close enough to it. How old is this pento? Is it still as strong as when first bottled?
I growl. I am not a nurse. I am an animal. On all fours, I gallop like a rabid lion and bulldoze into Kate Dranel, knock her on her ass, and beat a yellow bull bottom into her brains. At some point in my beating, and I hadn't appreciated this before, she pulls from a side-sewn pocket on her gown a giant antique nail, one big enough to drive through beams. I have a pile of them in the barn, given how I insisted on using as much reclaimed materials as possible to build Johanna's cottage. Kate jams the point end of the nail into my right eyebrow and drags down, puncturing my eye and cutting my face. She then takes the large nail head and jabs hard in several thrusts on my mouth, breaking some of my teeth, but I keep bashing her head. I am not a nurse. I am an animal. The throbbing pain beneath my action is distraction. Keep bashing. Keep beating her face. Her eyes close. I believe she's dead. I am not a nurse. No, I am a nurse. You are not a nurse right now. I lift my body off hers, the child inside me gone. I miscarried, I realize, which I knew the second I felt liquid thighs. I look to the blood that has fled me, losing the life within, a child, my soul. I'm a vacant animal now, a hollow hollow, a hole, a worthless vessel, nothing. I must move the bodies before the fire trucks come. I am a nurse.
Chapter 19. Mop. Over the last week, Cape Cod. This is the state I'm in, living in a falseness, an untruth. All I wanted to do this past week was tell Manny everything, so we could solve this mess or walk away from the past together. But even when we were in Cape Cod with my father and Aunt Sister Mary, I said nothing. I played the part they wanted me to play. The bride planning her wedding, so we could all be happy again, and so they would love me like before, unencumbered. I needed that. Needed the fog. And what to do with Auntie? Help her? Expose her? Was she guilty of actual murder, or what? There was indeed a literal skeleton in her basement. A woman in her barn. I took comfort in believing the skeleton wasn't my mother, for the patient record I'd ripped from the nail said, Dranel Kent, D.O.B. 12-18-71. Plus, the skeleton wore a man's wool suit. Cape Cod was a maddening deviation of me assuming the role of my mother, stepping into the suit of her identity and suppressing my fuller identity's other parts. I selected a date for my and Manny's future wedding, planning out where on the oceanfront Grand Chesterton lawn we'd marry, and beginning the gruel talk of menu selections. The GC, as the Grand Chesterton is known, is one of the finest five-star resorts in the world, and owned, of course, by Manny's family. No investors, no public offerings, no private equity firms or offshore shell companies, so the quality is not diluted for short-term gain, and the books not cooked for Wall Street. Just owned by his family and true. I had to be the bride. The willing, happy bride. But the dichotomy caused constant spikes of panic inside, made worse by the fact that I had to act them away on the outside. As I smiled at the offer of garland roses for the bridal arch, did they hear my dark thoughts, wondering if I was living, questioning whether what I saw was a mirage and I was chained in hell? Did the perky wedding coordinator with the date book know her scribbled notes sent my mind to Kent Dranel's daily record confirming he's still dead? Did Aunt Sister Mary know how her face, swollen from too many glasses of wine in the sun, looked like the face of the woman in the barn. I took a lot of spa appointments, saying I needed the rest and relaxation, only to sweat and shake so much on the table, the masseuse would end the effort, and I'd hide in the steam room, crying under a eucalyptus-drenched face towel. Manny went body surfing while I hid, and in between resort appointments with my father, we ate riotous expensive meals together, the four of us. And between those meals, Manny and I made aggressive love in our GC hotel room. Aunt Sister Mary Patience watched every move I made, like a hawk woman, beady green eyes and all. When I laughed, she squinted her beads, showing she questioned my authenticity and saw my duplicity. When I giggled over the GC caterer's suggestion that we serve bacon-wrapped scallops, as if we New Englanders would skip such an obvious obligatory choice, Sister Mary raised her eyebrows in a silent judgment and said, "Hmm." Aunt Sister Mary, glowering there, sitting on the fringe of our four-top table in the GC's swanky lounge restaurant, glitzy gold accents around, as if Don Draper might roll in any minute and light a silver-capped cigarette on a lighter wedged in the breasts of a black-dressed waitress. No, none of this was me, and Sister Mary called me out with her squinted eyes. When one of the cleavage waitresses bent her boobs in my face, Sister Mary lifted her eyebrows, as if saying, "I sent this girl as a test. How will you react? This is not you. None of this is you, and you know it." I suppose she expected me to cast dour eyes at the waitress for lowering her standards. But once again, Sister Mary misjudged me. I don't judge women on the choices they make with their own free will. If the girl wants to wear a low-cut dress, I seriously could not care less. It's not my personal choice, but my personal choices do not dictate anyone else's. I'm barely firm in them myself. And yet, since Sister Mary challenged me, I complimented the waitress on her revealing dress, fake giggled along with her, then winked at Sister Mary and Touche. None of this was the real me. This part I played in duplicity, and the wiry coat of it, the rank stench of phony fumes, riled me at my own self. Is Auntie Liv even aware of her own duplicity? Can she bring herself together? Can I? If she fails at duplicity, this dual insincere existence, will I? She's always claimed me as so much like her. But how much of the total identity pie does she claim of me? How much will I allow now in my emergence? Back at the GC's swanky lounge, my other aunt studied me in my mental struggle for full identity, full emergence. Aunt Sister Mary knew I'd never fake giggle about catered items, about bacon, about scallops, about cleavage. She knew I'd never fake giggle about anything. Except perhaps the notion that there exist universal truths immune to philosophy's relentless doubt. She knew a glitzy gold lounge with half-clothed women is the opposite environment I'd prefer for my wedding. More appropriate would be a candlelit underground ancient library in Italy with a close female relative or female scholar as the officiant. Maybe 3-4 tops witnesses in attendance. But these things we do in duplicity, denying authentic multiplicity, to feel love, even if false or hidden, to collect acceptance, to keep the peace by keeping things simple and binary, to avoid a sick reality, chains of protection. On the morning of the day we were to leave the GC, I woke early, passing through the lobby to get an early swim alone in the adult pool. My father wanted to leave earlier than planned, so we'd be packing in our cars around noon because Hurricane Angelo was to hit the entire coastline of Massachusetts. The Weather Channel expected Angelo's eye to hover over land the next day, But given the battering the Cape sometimes gets, and given the battering we expected in Rye, I had to agree it was best we get back. Yet given the hurry we'd be in after breakfast, I needed to squeeze in a swim, get back to my morning laps for my own well-being. I'd been dangerously off them since arriving at Auntie's. Like most morning, I was going to swim laps for an hour. I needed the sound of swishing water and popping underwater bubbles to soothe my brain. The safety of pressure on all sides. A pressure that buoys you, but that you can fight. Reject. For my brain, swimming is a beautiful meditation and powerful level setting. Had I been at Auntie's, I would have donned my wetsuit and swum my typical swim along the coastline and up to the Rockport point of Manny's property. Guess who was waiting on the ground floor on an upholstered bench, opposite the mouth of the open elevators? A paneled wood wall with embedded Freemason's tiles of metalwork backdropped Aunt Sister Mary on the bench. She wore a shapeless dress with brandless black leather shoes, black shoelaces, too. Her hair was in the tightest knot on the tip-top of her skull. I wondered if I pulled the pins, if her brain would bubble out. No need for a facelift with such torque. Her eye sockets pulled to each side, as if trying to see her own earlobes. Aha! Mary Olivia. I knew you'd be up early. I know you like your morning swims. Always training for your triathlons. Well, well. Sit here, she said, patting the taut fabric of the GC's bench seat. I sucked in my cheeks, drawing my inner mouth to my teeth. I flared my nostrils as I scraped to the bench and sat where she pat. She always says this, how I'm training for a triathlon. But doesn't she recognize I never do triathlons? I never train on the bike or run, the other key components of a triathlon. How can she not recognize that I just like to swim for hours? It is my calmness, the greatest of which comes when I am in the sea, doing laps back and forth, whether in front of our estate in Rye or along the rock line of Haddock Point State Park. It is the practice of my faith, if I were to believe in such things. Once again, I did not correct her. I let her believe my swims are mere practicalities of sport. She, in her enduring Catholic insistence, would never be willing to accept my intangible confidence in nature. She'd never accept the exaltation I give in my mind to ancient humanist philosophers like Epicurus and Lucretius. Blasphemy, she'd think. I think. She's so stiff, so stalwart, impenetrable. Auntie Liv has bled into comments about her. Is she so stalwart? She sure does act stalwart and impenetrable. What is truth? Am I permitting just a one-dimensional identity for her to allow for a simple definition, an easy way to reject her in whole? Maybe I need to try harder. In some ways, I wish I had Aunt Sister Mary's fortitude, like a brick house, like a granite church. So unlike my faith of water, which seeps through my hands if I try to cup it. I am a colander, she is a stone bowl. I know there's something going on between you and your Aunt Lynette, she said. Bam! A direct slap to my facade. Seriously? Can't you call her Liv like everyone else? You're so stuck up, I said like a brat, which I hated to do. But I had to deliver a caustic slap. I had to pretend to act my brittle age because I needed Sister Mary off the scent. I had never before talked to her like this. Never told her she was stuck up, never called her out for calling Auntie Liv by her formal name. I frankly, never before and really now, don't question Sister Mary's formality, nor do I wish to debate her choice to be formal. If stiffness is so important to her, so be it. But I had to slap her with my words on the GC's bench. And, being so stung by my words and shocked at how I acted, she leaned back, drew in her never-glossed lips, and swallowed. Mary Olivia, what has come into you? What exactly is going on? I know you're hiding something. My first caustic slap didn't work, and so she forced me to up the smug and, like a candidate for president, deflect from my own sins to hers. I hated to do it. But I had to. I couldn't allow or afford Aunt Sister Mary asking questions or snooping around. So, Aunt Sister Mary, I said, stressing the word sister, but spacing out my words in a calm delivery. Tell me, if you're so interested in getting into secrets, what's this secret you hold, eh? Why exactly did you quit the church anyway? What about how Auntie Liv mentioned a man coming to the Rye coach house in the night, and you screaming? Frankly, I didn't know if Aunt Sister Mary had a secret at all. My mother never, ever whispered to Auntie Liv in front of me. She never gossiped about anything in front of me. My mother always told me to never be cruel. Gossip is for the addle-minded, she'd say, adding a smile in her whimsical, frilly way and scrunching her nose all cute-like. She said things like, "Baby cakes, I don't care what grades you get. What I'm most proud of is your teacher adding a comment on how courteous you are to her and to the other students, and how you never gossip." And it's true. Before duplicity and insanity and selective amnesia came into my life, before I lost my mother, I did want to be kind, because it was natural for me. Easy. I had no energy to focus on other people's flaws, for I obsessed on my own, with my own to doubt. And then, over the last 2 years, I was vacant or apathetic or blindly invested in study or tutoring refugees, but not drilling into their backgrounds, and so had no cause or energy to gossip or be cruel. But on the GC's bench 2 days ago with Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost, I threw my instincts for kindness and my wish to not engage in debate with anyone out the resort's stained-glassed windows to the holy rolling sea. "So, what's this secret, Sister Mary?" I taunted like a child. "What did you say?" she coiled back. "I asked what your secret is. Why you left the church, or was it really, you were kicked out?" Deflect, deflect, deflect. Get her to not want to ask again about what's going on with Auntie Liv. "How dare you," she said, while standing and slapping my face for real. She slapped my face. I deserved it. Standing above me and folding her long, lean body at the waist, she seethed in my face. "You know nothing. A man. A man coming to the coach house. It's not what you think, not some dirty sex with a nun's secret, Mary Olivia. Not even close. But my truth is none of your business." And then she stormed off, but turned about 10 feet away to say, "How dare you?" upon a snarl. Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost was so furious, she left before we were scheduled, took an Uber all the way from the Cape to Rye, and barricaded herself in the coach house, something I knew when she texted me and my father. "I'm home at Rye in my rooms. Don't call or knock. Leave me be. I have all I need in here to survive the storm." I, on the other hand, drove home as scheduled about midday with Manny, my father taking his own car. I didn't let on to them anything about why Aunt Sister Mary left early. Manny and I drove straight back to his house by Haddock Point. And I told him I was going to go on and visit with Auntie. I asked him to let me go alone so I could visit with her for a couple of hours before dinner. I could delude myself into packing my wake-up into a single second. The one physical event of Aunt Sister Mary slapping my face with a definite thwack. But that's too dramatic, too literal, too neat and tied up in a bow, easy for Hollywood, necessary for a strict 90-minute movie. Like a cliche light bulb pinged over my head in a Roadrunner cartoon. The reality is, I'd been scraping and crawling for the lip of insanity's well, clawing to really emerge ever since I slipped back down after finding the woman in the barn. Clawed up but slipped again when I figured her for the woman on the rocks 2 years ago. Clawed up a few feet but slipped again when I found the wool-suited skeleton. Straining through acting, crying in steam rooms, hiding my thoughts, pushing my mind at the GC was all me, clawing, clawing, clawing on the rocks of my well, straining to emerge. Sister Mary's slap was the rope that met my hands stretching from the depths, seeking any help to pull me out. She pulled me out. I was ready. That was yesterday, and I haven't returned to Manny's since. I didn't get a chance to tell him about all these secrets at Auntie's. Did he find out on his own? Is he alive? Yesterday, upon returning from the GC, I cut through the secret bramble trail and hit upon the space of the boarded, burned cottage hole. I followed along through the stone path toward Auntie's lawn, brushing up the scent of rosemary and basil from the herb garden by the side room on the barn, and then, to my right, the spiral sunflower congress. The flower heads bloomed, swaying in their height in the high winds. I heard Auntie humming and singing in the side room to her patient woman. "I whistle in the thistle and I stop at the rock." She sang these two lines over and over. I walked softer past the barn, tiptoeing down the path to her front door. Deviating from the path, I visited her favorite willow, sprang the bottom latch on that birdhouse she and I made long ago, and extracted the hidden set of all the house keys, which includes the front door and the key to Auntie's bedroom, which has access to the attic. The hydrangeas and all the other flowers bloomed in the August sunshine, seemingly lifting their petals to touch my skin as I passed. Keys in hand, I headed toward Auntie's blue front door. Oh, to emerge, to awake from cloudy dreams to definition and enhancements, to have purpose and questions, and to be seeking answers and resolutions, however horrific. To be alive. To know I'm real. To be empowered, having chosen to take the keys, which were always there, and unlock rooms in literal and figurative ways. To have power. I clenched my hands and fists to bottle the thrill of being in command of my own mind. The hibiscus petals at the entrance flopped as I passed, the size of them outgrowing the support of flower veins. But the flower's flopping largeness didn't stall me. A flashing from the windows above stopped me. Something overhead in the daylight glared. Glared again. Glared again. Three flashes. "I love you" in flashlight talk. No, I thought. No way. I'm imagining flashes because I want lighted messages so bad. I stepped backward off the granite front stoop, craned my head to the attic dormer, and for sure this time saw, clear as day, three flashes. "I love you," like my mother used to flash me from her cabin to my upstairs room at Auntie's. Three more flashes from an attic dormer. "I love you," And then a series that didn't quit. I love you, 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 I love you. Auntie's singing in the barn wafted to me, giving a sense of safety. Auntie is occupied. I whistle in the thistle and I stop at the rock, she sang from afar. More flashes from above. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Flashing lights of I love you became a siren call. My heart ran ahead of me, it beat so fast. I slipped through the front door, up the stairs, down the hall, scraped to the right key for Auntie's bedroom door, busted through Auntie's bedroom, up through her stairwell, and burst into the finished attic. I stalled on the carpet, looking at a woman in a rocker, propped sitting by a dormer with flashlight in hand. Pop over on her lap, and a kerchief blinding her hair to the world. A chain wound around her ankle and attached at the other end to a bed leg. The metal scraping I heard on the first night. My mouth dropped to the floor, as did my body when I lost control of my muscles.
Chapter 20, Auntie. 2 years ago. I am an animal nurse. I lost my baby, my third baby gone. My love is dead upstairs in Mop's room, murdered. My sister, I'm holding her wrist, is close to death and duct-taped on the burners of my gas stove. But she's not dead yet. Her murderer is possibly dead or dying on my kitchen floor, her head bashed in by the bottom of the yellow bowl. Her face is cut, my eye punctured, my teeth smashed, my left hand cut and in need of sutures, blood on my face. I am an animal nurse. I must act. I must be clinical so the gray clouds won't come. This is my job, only my job. I push every emotion I should have out, like I'm trained to do in catastrophic emergency situations. This is war, and I'm on the front line, in the most critical medical tent, like victims of a mass shooting coming to my ER. Triage. There's several forms of triage. I currently find myself in the mass casualty, low-to-no-resources scenario, and thus must enact the most complex of triage, continued integrated triage. If I were in the ER, I'd label patients on their chances of survival and dole out the limited medical resources to those with the best chance of survival, leaving to the side the ones with obliterated brains or blown-open hearts, as they have the least chance of survival. I'm known at St. Jerome's as the best nurse to build the strategy for and execute incredibly effective, quick, and practical continuous integrated triage. I never under-triage or over-triage. Shock will help me block reality. Adrenaline will boost my advanced efficiency skills. Here we go. I must act fast before authorities come. Psychologically, I'll pay later for pushing everything to the back of my brain, for activating only my executive function and none of the emotion or short-term memory in my hippocampus. But I won't have a chance at any livable later if I don't do exactly that. So here I am, a robot. In tonight's case, I have one medical resource, me, and four people to assess. Kent Drenal. Assessment, dead. Value, zero, already dead. He serves humanity no longer. He is worthless. However, his corpse frames me in murder and is thus toxic. I must deal with it. Kate Drenal. Assessment, might be dead. Significant head injuries, external bleeding on skull and in hair, suspect intracranial bleeding as well. Unconscious, needs CAT and or PET scans and emergency surgery to remove likely hematoma, blood clot, bleeding in brain. I don't have the equipment to do scans here, and I'm not trained to perform brain surgery. Value, less than zero. She's possibly dead, possibly seriously brain injured. If she survives, she will exist with diminished mental capacity after a long road of rehab. She will be a drain on medical resources. Also, she is incurably and violently insane and serves no useful value to society. Rather, she is harmful to society. Like Kent, her body frames me in crime and is thus toxic. I must deal with it. Johanna. Assessment.
She might die, is unconscious from unconfirmed quantity and potency of undated pentobarbital vial straight into her neck, unsure if hit vein. I can do nothing medically except wait to see the effects. I am holding her wrist, assessing her pulse, which is weak and dangerously spaced, but it's there. Value. Infinite. Johanna has the most value of anyone on Earth, and with care and attention and aggressive medical rehab and maintenance, she could survive to her prior state. I must deal with her, treat her in secret, if she even survives the possibly fatal level of injection she just received. If anyone runs toxicology on her blood and finds the pentobarbital in her, they'll link it to me. So what if they link the pentobarbital to me? Shut up! Shut up and work! The reason, Lynette, you fucking imbecile, is you have no idea what Kate Drainel wrote of in her computer or planted in Ken's emails. She has his password. She might link pentobarbital to you, which would link to your sister, and then there would be questions about Kent, who will be reported missing, and so will go an investigation. Think. Then there's the matter of dead Vicky. No, don't think. Stop thinking. Work. Me. Assessment. I need to avoid jail. Have a serious eye injury. Smashed teeth. Slashed hand. But these injuries are not life-threatening. I am suffering a miscarriage. Blood on my legs. Value. Limited. And specific. My eye throbs. I can't see out of it. Blood muddies my sight. I need stitches on my face and on my hand. The blood seems to have stopped flowing between my legs, but I need to be sure it doesn't start up again. I can't be leaving a blood trail of myself around this house and outside and highlighting for black light all the places I'm about to go. I will treat myself first, so I can deal with all three bodies before authorities come, so I don't go to jail. My relative value to humanity? Well, having lost my third child, almost none. The only value I hold now is the immeasurable value of bringing Johanna, who holds the most value, back to a life worth living. And if I fix her after that, I am of zero value and can be gone from this cruel life. I refuse to be captured and thrown in jail for even a second of breath on this earth. In the ER, I would never include in my assessments the relative value of each human life in comparison to the next. So while I must prefer to save the life of a child, as opposed to some haggard drunk past his prime, if the child is brain dead and the drunk has a bleeding cut I can stitch so he doesn't bleed out, and it's only me and there are no other resources, I'd, in the normal course of business, devote my care to the drunk. But here, I am assessing the value of each of these lives before me and including in my quick assessment of myself. As I cut a piece of duct tape from Johanna, I look out the bay window to the fire, bright now inside the cottage but still contained on the bed. I estimate about a half hour before the world descends upon me. Triage. I'm the best at triage. The best triage nurse. Terrific. I grab an absorbent washcloth and a long section of duct tape off Johanna and, given how thick the gluey adhesive is on this brand of tape, duct tape the washcloth through the thumb and forefinger of my cut left hand. Next, using a corner of a towel from the laundry basket, I dab away the blood on my face and press hard to stem the flow for a good 2 minutes. I fold the open skin together and slam another section of duct tape I've cut from the slumping Johanna over my sliced eye. The pain is unlike any pain ever experienced, but since it is so excruciating, this is my new normal. I work. The tape should hold the fold of the cut and quell the blood while I work. It won't last long. I need to work fast. With the rest of the towel, I wipe my legs of the blood and all the spots on the floor where it dripped. I wipe up the vomit, too. The heaviest of my blood and the vomit is now soaked up in the towel. I'll run a mop last, after scooping up all the broken pottery. First, heavy fluids and bodies cleanup. Next, sterilizing cleanup. In case I start bleeding again, I grab a Kotex from the kitchen bathroom, stick it to a pair of fresh underwear, and pull them on. The bloody towel and old underwear I shove in the oven. First, Kent. In nurse training, they teach you how to leverage the full weight of a man up to double your weight over your back to drag him to wherever you need to treat him, or in my present case, stash his dead body. I run up to Mop's room with another section of duct tape. Before slinging the bloodless Kent over my back as trained, I slap the duct tape over the slice in his neck, because I can't bear to look at it, and I can't bear to consider his head